Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. As we begin by taking a look at science, that is, to me, that's an endlessly fascinating topic. And we're lucky to have Bassam Shakashiri with us to talk about the opportunities and challenges in the world of science. He's a professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, also president of the American Chemical Society. So he's been traveling in relationship to that very important presidential role that he has. Bassam, always great to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Larry. It's always a special joy for me to be not only with you but with the audience. I enjoy the interaction with them. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
And I want to give the number. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment, are you a science fan? Where did that love come from? Or maybe you pursue it as a hobby or profession. What might have inspired you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly we'd love to hear from you. We have a new chancellor at the University of Wisconsin.
I'm very pleased with the announcement that was made yesterday. Of course, it has to be confirmed by the regents. Mm-hmm. But I and the faculty and the students and the staff, the entire community, are looking forward to a new leadership. We hope that Chancellor-designate Blank will arrive here in the summer. It'll be a smooth transition from David Ward. I have to say something about David.
He did a great job.
Fabulous job. Fantastic job. He not only in this round, but in the first round when he was our chancellor. And Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, owes David a great deal of gratitude. And we express appreciation to him and to the staff that he put together to serve our university. The new chancellor comes with considerable experience in Washington and in sister Big Ten institutions. Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin, has great challenges, especially in terms of our state becoming more robust economically, and education is the key to progress, Larry. The University of Wisconsin, just a powerhouse here with great talent among the faculty, the graduate students, the staff. We have to continue to smooth out and improve on the connections with each corner of the state, with the state government. There's a great deal that we can do for the state. There's a great deal that the state continues to do for us. Mm-hmm. So I know I speak for fellow faculty members that we're excited about the new appointment. And she has spoken about her interests not only in science but in the liberal arts, which I think is a tremendous plus. Yep. So we are truly a university, and we're looking to have her on board as soon as possible.
Frank in Wausau has a question for you. I think it's kind of interesting. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I just wanted to relate a story. As I was listening, reminded me of back when I was in second grade at Schubert Elementary School in Chicago. I think it was 1957. It was our science teacher, Mrs. Aces. Now, I'm 63 years old now, but I still remember this vividly. A science teacher, Mrs. Aces, came to our classroom and went to all the classrooms in the school to say, look, the Russians have sent a satellite around the Earth, and children, we really have to study our science and our arithmetic. Nowadays they call it math. And I remember as a second grader, I was 7 years old, and some of my friends, oh, my God, if we don't study our math and our science, the Russians are going to come. And I want to say that sparked a tremendous interest in science in me and a number of my friends in grade school, you know, through high school and college. I went on to medical school, and I'm a family doctor here in Wausau. But that story just sparked into my head as you were describing the interest in science. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. I too, remember the launch of Sputnik in early October of 1957. Just 3 weeks after I and my parents and two younger sisters arrived in the United States from my native Lebanon, yes, Sputnik sparked a great deal of interest in science and in the teaching of science. And it was perceived as a military threat. The country rallied. The government took special interest in enticing and inviting and supporting people to go into science careers and the teaching of science. But you know, Frank, I am also grateful for these opportunities that developed as a result of that Sputnik launch. But now we have more profound considerations to think about in terms of why we should encourage young people to go into science. Science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. New innovations, discoveries, technology transfer contribute to the well-being of society at large. So we need a well-trained technical force, but we also want to make sure that the people who go into careers in science are educated in other areas too. So it's not only the technical training, which is essential.
Right.
Technical training is necessary but not sufficient, so that we can put the results of scientific and technological advancements into good use, and we help our fellow citizens in the United States and around the globe to enjoy the benefits of these advances. So education, as I mentioned earlier, is the key to progress in society. And we have now difficult challenges facing us economically. You know, we might as well bring this up now, Larry. The sequestration of the federal funds is going to have an effect on the state of Wisconsin and everyone in the United States. But Frank, I thank you for your comments and for your observations.
Yeah, appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Last week, Bassam, you were in Washington, D.C. for meetings. You met with the president's science advisor and the president's council of advisors on science and technology. I imagine sequestration came up, but what was your main focus for that meeting?
We were invited to meet with the White House Office of Science and Technology and the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology to discuss a report. During my presidency as of the American Chemical Society, I was president last year. Mm-hmm. This year, I'm the immediate former president.
Yeah.
I formed a Blue Ribbon Commission and asked them to examine the purposes of graduate education in the chemical sciences. I gave them two specific charges. The first one, what are the purposes of graduate education in the chemical sciences? And the second part that I asked them to think about, how do these purposes relate to serving societal needs and the aspirations of students who go into science and technology. And they completed their report last December, so we were asked to go to the White House and discuss the findings, the conclusions, and the recommendations of this report. I was accompanied by a distinguished faculty member from the California Institute of Technology, Professor Jackie Barton, and also the chief technology officer from Dow Chemical Company, Dr. William Banholzer. And the three of us made a presentation with the science advisor and the council of advisors for a whole hour. Actually, it's on the web. People can go and watch it. It was a very good exchange, a very good discussion about the preparation of 22-year-olds and what their professional life is likely to be in the next 50 years. Why do I say 50 years? Because typically that's the duration of the professional life of a 22-year-old. they may retire a little after you and I retire, Larry, but that's and the findings of the commission and their conclusions are very carefully worded. So this conversation is part of an effort that the American Chemical Society is undertaking to implement the conclusions and the recommendations of this commission. For anyone interested in higher education, if you go to my website, scifund.org, scifun.org, you'll find the link there that takes you to the text of this report. It's not a very long report. It's actually 60 pages. But if you read the 20-page summary, that's enough. I have a copy for you here, Larry.
Ah, thank you.
Not that you should read it now, but so that was the
– I'll take it with me.
That was the purpose of the discussion, a very significant exchange. And people can watch it if they wish on the web right now.
Are you – this sequestration business, I want to go back to that for a minute because it looks like – here at the, for example, the University of Wisconsin, we have a number of millions and millions of dollars in research grants that come from the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health. These look, at least some of those funds look to be in trouble with the sequestration.
Larry, let me start by saying that our country must pay attention to the fiscal needs that we have. There's no question that we have deficit spending. There's no question that the national debt is mounting. Our elected representatives have the responsibilities and obligations to take responsible action in this regard. So sequestration may not be the best thing to do, but that's what we have now. The consequences can be hurtful all around, not only to the research enterprise, but to the education enterprise. It can be hurtful to everyone who is involved and affected by the use of federal funds. So, for example, the National Science Foundation, in planning for what they have to do with the cuts that are about to happen, have begun to happen, they will, for example, award 1,000 fewer new grants, and they will honor the continuing grants that have been funded for multiple years, but they will then deprive young investigators from pursuing research studies that can benefit society. And these research activities take place, as you said, not only at UW-Madison, but elsewhere around the country. So this will also have a ripple effect on the economy, because when University of Wisconsin-Madison receives $1 billion of that's our budget in terms of research, and that's cut by the feds because of the sequestration, it's going to have an effect on the young people, the young researchers, and what they might do or not do in pursuing careers as faculty members. It's a signal to the graduate students that maybe their future is somewhat in jeopardy. And that's going to affect the economy because fewer dollars will be flowing locally from the feds. So that's why I go back and say we should urge our elected representatives to act in responsible ways to deal with the deficit situation that we have here, and try to understand each other on both sides of the aisle, and try to work in respectful ways in addressing a very challenging and difficult situation. And the sooner, if I may be direct about this, Larry, the sooner they get off name-calling and work on what's really good for our country, the better.
Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison and past president of the American Chemical Society, our guest here today. You can join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question on my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. I'm Larry Miller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fun listening to John, talking about the afternoon program, John Muntz's program. He'll be visiting with Stan Temple, professor, former professor emeritus at the Department of Wildlife Ecology here at the UW, as they talk about de-extinction.
Wow. That should be very interesting.
Yeah, it should be. Well, and we try to highlight science programs pretty often on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You do. Wisconsin Public Radio, and you especially, Larry, you have guests that talk about science, education, technology. And Larry, tomorrow morning at 6:02, something will occur at 6:02 a.m. Central Daylight Time. Do you know what it is?
It is called the vernal equinox.
It is the vernal equinox. It is the spring equinox. And so I have a question that I like to ask the listening audience. If they could briefly call in and explain why we have four seasons.
Huh.
What is it that causes the four seasons to occur? So
right.
that's a question I throw out to the audience. We have the vernal equinox in the summertime. We're going to have the summer equinox. And excuse me.
And we will. And I'll tell you what. We got somebody who calls in and gives the right answer. We'll send them a copy of your book.
Sure.
On advancing graduate education in the chemical sciences.
I bet most people know the explanation for it.
Well, I'll tell you what. Here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you got an answer to that question, or maybe, you know, if you don't or you don't want to answer that question, you can ask your own question. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And the first person we get on the air who's got the answer to that, we'll mail you a copy of Advancing Graduate Education in the Chemical Sciences. How's that sound? And I tell you what, we've got every line just like that.
Just like that.
Filled up.
We have some answers?
Oh, yeah, we do. As a matter of fact, we sure do. Let's go to Rich in Oshkosh. Rich, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Hi.
It's the tilt of the Earth, the axis, the Earth axis that causes the four seasons. Rotating. Oh yes, we have to rotate around the sun too.
So could you say a little more so that we can? You know, one of the important things that I feel strongly about is communicating science in a manner that is understood. So Rich, if you're explaining to your next door neighbor, what is it about the tilt of the Earth?
Well, I would tell them that we're moving at about 84,000 miles an hour, and we are going counterclockwise around the sun. And in each quarter quadrant, there is a different season. In the opposite March and October, this is when we have the equinox, and the solstice is when we get into the June 21st approximately, and the December 21st.
But what about the tilt, Rich? I'm pushing you a little bit here.
Oh, the tilt. Okay, what about the tilt? The tilt would be, which gives us the angle of the sun. The angle of the sun changes as we rotate around the sun.
So the vernal equinox is tomorrow, and what's happening in the southern hemisphere tomorrow?
The opposite. They go... Oh, no, they are also the same. Excuse me, the same. I'm thinking summer, winter. Yes, it's identical to the same.
So in South America, will it be the beginning of spring or the beginning of fall tomorrow?
It'll be the beginning of fall.
Beginning of fall, yes. And so the tilt of the Earth is responsible for the having the four seasons. In the summer, we'll have the summer solstice. In the winter, we'll have the winter solstice.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the fall in September, around September 20th or so. So, Rich, that's very good. May I ask you another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Why does the Earth tilt? What is the cause of the tilt, do you know?
The Earth tilts because... The the way it was set into motion probably 4 billion years ago when it got spewed off of probably the sun or whatever caused the planets to evolve the way they did.
So the Earth, is, as far as we know, is about 4.5 billion years old, and as you say, there was a very heavy bombardment about 3.5 billion years ago or so that hit the Earth and caused it to tilt. And a chunk, I mean, that's how the moon got chopped off the Earth. And mm-hmm. And so that is actually the explanation as to why there is a tilt. Imagine if we had not been, if the Earth had not been hit by this very heavy object, maybe life as we know it now would not exist on the planet.
Yeah.
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 Very good, Rich. Thank you so much.
Could I add one more thing?
Sure.
We just happened to buy a sundial at the antique shop, and we thought it would be good to put in our garden. And we placed it in there, and it, we found out it was from the south of the equator. They make a different type of sundial in the south of the equator, and we said, well, this thing doesn't work. Well, when we turned it upside down, the way South America looks at it, we found out it works correctly. So it was a discovery that we never heard about. And I wonder if you heard anything about such a difference in the way that they have sundials south of the equator compared to sundials that we have north of the equator.
This is one of the questions that I ask and of audiences in my public presentations when I'm doing science demonstrations, that to think about the movement that we call clockwise and counterclockwise, mm-hmm. and I ask them, where does that come from? And, of course, the obvious answer, it comes from clocks, mm-hmm. but what's the origin of it? And the origin of it is the movement of the sundial and that we observe when we – and then I asked them, was the sundial first developed, as far as we know, and used in the northern hemisphere or in the southern hemisphere? And I think about that. And then I ask them to think about the movement in the southern hemisphere. And so Rich, you're just fabulous in sharing this observation with us. It makes us all think about what we observe and try to rationalize it, make sense of it, and to engage in meaningful conversations about a variety of scientific concepts. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for joining us, Rich. You can join in, too, by the way, with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And I'm skipping around a little bit here. I'm talking about education when you're on with us, of course. And the UW has announced expanding its offering of, I don't know, is MOOCs is a proper pronunciation, massive open online courses?
That's the right pronunciation. It's becoming a well-known acronym. University of Wisconsin, other universities are carefully examining this use of technology in the delivery of education. MOOC, M-O-O-C, Massive Open Online.
Massive Open Online.
Courses.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that my colleagues everywhere are thinking about this and making sure that it is carefully examined in terms of what it really means to deliver information on the web, mm-hmm. Whether there is a charge to it or not, that can be discussed. My thinking, my observation, my concern is to be sure that we do not substitute the all-important human one-on-one personal interaction in the educational process as distinguished from the training process. Training is a subset of education. So acquiring technical skills is something that's really, really very important. But learning more about when to use those skills, what to use them for, when not to use them, that is the differentiation I make between training and education. And you can do some of that on the web, but I am very hopeful that we will never, ever depersonalize the all-important human interaction in education. We are an institution of higher education,
mm-hmm.
And we, of course, train people to be technically competent to solve very important societal problems. But we also are responsible, educated individuals who care about the proper use of the technical training that we have. So that's my concern about MOOC. And of course, there's another concern that I have. If you think carefully about where this might go, Larry, let's say we offer all the first year and second year courses mm-hmm. On the web. That's going to affect the size of our university because the students will not be on campus.
Yep.
And if the students are not on campus, then the size of the faculty will be altered.
Mm-hmm.
And the university as we know it now will drastically change. The university is an agent of change in our society. Universities are constantly changing. Even though some people say they are resistant to change, and they are resistant to some change, but the change has to be purposeful. It has to be clear as to why the changes are being made. There are economic factors, there are educational factors, there are all kinds of different factors. So the electronic revolution is with us.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that the electronic revolution is going to have as great an impact as the industrial revolution has had on us, but we are in the infancy stage right now. So I hope we do the right kinds of experiments. We learn from the mistakes, whether it's MOOC or something else that relates to electronic technology, and we do the right things not only for ourselves but for the people who trust us to educate them.
Markina in Madison, I want to give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling. Hi. What's on your mind?
How are you? Well, I have a couple questions about sunrise.
Okay.
What days of the year does the sun actually rise in what we'd call true east?
What days does the sun rise in the true east?
I honestly don't know the direct answer to your question, but...
Let me rephrase it.
No, let me ask you a question, if I may, Markina. Does the sun really rise?
Well, for the sake of this discussion.
No, I don't mean to deflect. I don't mean to deflect your question at all. Yes, we observe sunrise and sunset. Yes, and
okay, thank you.
Yes, we do.
But being on Earth, I have observed that when I stand and face what I think is the east, in April it rises at one point, or different months, different places.
Yes, it does.
In other words, there's a huge arc of the circumference of the horizon. Day by day, as I watch the sunrise, it moves. It keeps moving. In the winter toward, I guess, the north, I'm not sure, or maybe the south. So, but at one point, like at the equinox, shouldn't it be at a central point where it varies, fluctuates back and forth from?
Well, the movement of the Earth, the Earth goes around the sun, of course, and then the Earth rotates around its axis, the tilted axis, and those two movements are responsible for the sunrise and the sunset and the length of the day, the length of daylight. The day is 24 hours and a few seconds, but daylight time and so on. And
I think what I'm throwing in, Professor, is a compass. You know, our compass that's based on needle pointing north. As feeble as our, our human measurements are from this perspective, if my right hand is, say, pointing straight north, and if I'm looking...
Well, Markina, let me promise you, everyone else that's listening, I will provide a succinct response to your question on my website. So if you go there, I'll give you some references you can go to. So please visit my website. Give me 24 hours to do this. SciFun, SCIFUN.org. and then look on under Science on the Radio, and I'll put a succinct explanation there. Thank you, Marquino.
Thank you for calling. And while you're there, we posted up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, Science is Fun Home Experiments, because you've got lots of really cool ones. And Judith picked one out, and something about a fire can weaken the rubber in a balloon and cause it to burst. And here's a home experiment. In this one, you'll find out how you can hold a balloon directly in a flame without breaking it.
We have lots of enjoyable experiments. We all learn from doing experiments. They are on the website. You can download them and do them safely at home.
Yeah.
And enjoy them. And Larry, let me just also say that on the website, we also announce upcoming events that people can go to and participate. So coming up in April, for example, we have science expeditions at UW-Madison.
Yeah.
We have Engineering Expo. Later on in the fall, we're going to have the Wisconsin Science Festival. Near the end of the year, we're going to have Once Upon a Christmas Cheery in the Lab of Shakashiri. So there are all kinds of events that people can participate in. The website is a good resource.
Randy in Kewaskum, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my degree is more in applied science. I'm an ag major, so there's where it kind of the rubber hits the road. You were talking about the electronic revolution and the online courses. I have a question. Basically, when it comes to the sciences, a lot of the learning comes from lab work. And how do you translate lab work into an online course? Because you miss a lot. If you don't do it in the lab and don't do the hands-on, there's a lot that's just going to go over your head.
Yeah. Very, very good observation, Randy. Thank you so much for making it. Yes, this is of great interest to me and to others as well. Hands-on experiences and minds-on experiences are extremely important. Science is an experimental human endeavor. Of course, there are theoretical works in science as well. But the instructions, the delivery of knowledge via the web is not so much interactive. You don't deal with the real chemicals. You can see someone manipulating them, mixing them, and so on. To me, there's no substitute for the hands-on experiences that we have in our laboratories. Undergraduate laboratories, graduate laboratories, high school, even middle school, and a great ability as human beings have to ask questions and then do something to try to find out what happens. So this is a situation that the digital technology has not yet coped with, and it is the subject of a lot of conversation, a lot of experimentation, how to enable individuals to carry out experiments themselves. There are some experiments you can do on the web.
Yeah.
Some physics experiments, for example, some psychology experiments you can do.
I think they've even tried to set it up so that you can, in my day, I dissected a frog in a class. I just dissected a rat in another class. Now they have sort of an online way that you can dissect, but I don't think it's the same at all as actually having the frog or the mouse or the rat or whatever.
Well, we have to adapt this technology that we've come up with now to serve our purposes. And
yeah.
we, as I say, there are people experimenting with online courses that have some laboratory components, but we're not there yet in terms of a full substitution of the digital approach to the actual doing of the experiment. So thank you, Randy, for that observation, for the question.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. We had, there's another education topic, but just before we wind up here, which is charter schools. And you're an advocate for strong science and math education. Is there an opinion you have on charter schools?
Well, charter schools are with us. I mean, the state, our state, other states allow them and support them. I think that the way to improve the quality of education everywhere is to strengthen the public education system. Charter schools came up 20-plus years ago because some schools were failing and the parents wanted to move their children to another location and to have a chartered approach to education. I think the jury is out as to how well that has worked. But I would like to have more emphasis on buttressing the support and improving the quality of education in the public school system. If a school is failing, we should try to understand why and try to make it stronger or even shut it down. But to pretend that by taking good students and putting them elsewhere, that's going to help that school, I think the data show otherwise. So that's one view I have about charter schools. I know this is part of the controversial topic that people think about. I do believe strongly, I want to say it for the third time, in the public education system that we have in our country and how critical it is for us at the local level to support the public schools and try to assure that they offer the best quality education to all students.
But Sam, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And I want to remind everybody about your website, www.sifun.org. That's SCIFUN.org. There's so much there, and I really like going to it. Thank you, Bassam.
Thank you, Larry, and happy spring.
Happy spring to you as well. Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, past president of the American Chemical Society. He'll be back, and we'll do this always again. It's always a treat to visit with him. He's a smart guy, isn't he? Coming up, we're going to talk with another smart person, Donna Watzer, Poison Education Coordinator, and she's here with us because it's Poison Prevention Week. She has lots of great information to share about keeping you and your loved ones safe from poisoning. So stay with us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.